Our next speaker in our keynote is Randy Udall, who is the former director of the Community Office for Resource Efficiency, or CORE. Randy, we were pleased to have him, I think, in 2001 come speak before REV, and travels around the country really giving us data, giving us a rousing perspective on a lot of energy issues. And we're, as I say, thrilled to have him here and bring you some information from a larger scale. So without further, thank you, Randy.
Well, I'm a little overwhelmed by how many people are in this room, but I think that that's indicative of where we are today as a nation, where you guys are as a state, and it's really an optimistic signal of where we're headed. There are about 40 or 50 or 60 seats up here in the front, so please come forward. I'm going to show some images. If we can drop the lights, maybe just the chandeliers or some of the down lights, just darken the room a little bit if somebody knows how to do that. These slides will come out and show a little bit better. I think the switches are on the wall back there, so somebody can just play with them. You know, we live in a really interesting moment right now. I was thinking about going to the library, and so I called downstairs to the front desk, and I said, I'm unfamiliar with Burlington. Can I walk to the library? And the clerk said, oh, no, that's not possible. I said, well, how far is it? She said, a half a mile. Last fall, I had a chance to spend some time with this man. He's a farmer in Denmark. His name is Soren Hermansen. He lives on a little island in Denmark. And the people on this island, it's called Samso, they have been engaged over the last 10 years in the most audacious forward-looking energy experiment anywhere on the planet. The Danes had a contest to select a single island and try to run it off of renewable energy. And Samso entered the contest and won. This is a picture of the island. There are about 4,000 people living on it in a dozen small villages. Quite conservative people. These aren't progressive sort of Birkenstock people. These are hardworking farmers. Soren himself is a farmer. He said, I came back to Samso and I began farming beets. He said, I like to talk, and the vegetables weren't responding. So they hired Soren to run this energy project, and over the last 10 years, they've converted their entire energy economy to renewable energy. Since World War II, they had been importing electricity through an underground cable and importing liquid fuels quite expensively, the same way we do here in the U.S., through barges that were coming offshore. So you have 4,000 people there living on this little island. And journalists from all over the world now have come to Samso to report on it. It's been written up in the New York Times, the New Yorker magazine, Outside magazine. And the journalists generally refer to the farmers on Samso. They're all very muscular, and the journalists always call these farmers beefy. A beefy farmer said this, or a beefy farmer said that. And like farmers everywhere, some of these farmers have trouble finding wives, so they've developed a dating service on the island. It's called farmerdating.dk. And I went to this website to see what sort of personals these guys would post. This was the first one I found there. Beefy farmer with large tractor seeks attractive woman with boat. Must be able to sew and clean fish. Send picture of boat and motor. So it occurred to me that Samso and Vermont have a lot in common. This guy's been growing rapeseed, a biofuel to run his tractors with, and this was a pretty simple dream, but over the last 10 years, these folks have invested $70 million of their own money, some of it is bank loans, to build this renewable energy system on their island. They have district heating that they use biomass and straw to heat buildings. They have some solar on the island, and they have about 20 megawatts of wind onshore and offshore. This big wind farm here cost about $25 million to build. And one of the interesting things that Danes have figured out is how to own these things in common. So you're not only getting electricity, every time those blades move, you get both income and power, which is a wonderful thing to figure out. I mean, it's something we've struggled with here in the U.S., how you really figure out this community ownership thing. But in theory, you know, one in five Danes own shares in a utility wind turbine now. There are only 600,000 of you here in Vermont. I mean, is there any reason that 100,000 Vermonters couldn't own a piece of a big wind farm in the state and use that community ownership as a way to mitigate some of these land use concerns that, you know, that are real concerns and real issues? I think the greatest gift that these people on SAMHSA, these farmers, have given their kids, these kids are up in the nacelle of a wind turbine 150 feet off the ground, and they live in these farmhouses in the rear, and they've given these kids a gift of understanding, these children understand the energy basis of their civilization. They understand their energy future. They're directly connected to it in a way that American teenagers no longer are. Vermont, you guys ran for hundreds of years, for centuries, on wood, sunlight, and water power. You did it once, you'll do it again. It's just a question of how long it takes to get there. After visiting with Soren, I sort of asked myself, well, is this SAMHSA just a fairy tale? Is it a fairy tale, or is it a parable? Is it an allegory? Is it a story that we're, is it a journey that we're all going to undertake over the next 10, 20, 30, 40, 50, 60, 70, 80 years? We've become quite strange in the United States. It wasn't until 1880 that fossil fuels eclipsed renewable energy in this country, but in the last century we've taken this quite bizarre turn. There's about 30,000 subdivisions in the United States where it's illegal to sun-dry your clothes. This woman is in the Federal Witness Protection Program, so we can't... one of my favorite writers, a guy named Loren Isley, he wrote that man's long adventure with knowledge has been a climb up the heat ladder. The creature that crept further through the glitter of blue glacial nights now lives surrounded by the hiss of steam and the roar of engines. And he is himself a flame, a great roaring furnace. Just walk out after the conference this afternoon, walk out on the bridge that looks down on the interstate and think about those cars zooming past. If you had walked all over the world 200 years ago and you had gone looking for the most powerful prime mover on the planet, you would have found a 20 horsepower windmill in Denmark, maybe a 30 horsepower water mill in England somewhere. Most powerful machine on the planet, 30 horsepower, modern snowmobile, 150, typical American new car, 200. So when you get in a car, you have six times more power at the tip of your toe than you could have found anywhere on the planet just 200 years ago. For most of human history, we've been farming the sun. There are many ways to do that. You can do it by planting rice like this woman is in Vietnam, or grazing cattle and sheep, dairy cattle, fishing the open ocean. And that's a different world. You can still find remnants of this old, ancient way of life in the more primitive parts of the world, places like parts of Asia or New Hampshire, maybe. And when you talk to anthropologists about this ancient way of life, they'll tell you, well, you know, it was characterized by being much slower and quieter. And it was also characterized by its absence of machinery. All the work in these cultures was done by muscle power. The muscle power of domesticated animals, or men and women. And furthermore, they'll tell you, well, women were providing 75% of all the muscle power And this tradition of women doing most of the work is alive and well today on the planet. But every few hundred years, some men show up that are interested in doing work. So here we are in 1908. This is the Wright brothers. They had never flown above water before, so they've strapped a canoe to the bottom of their plane. Now, the Wright brothers, does anybody know what their occupation was? They were bicycle mechanics. Neither one of them went to college. But in the space of 3 years, they unlocked this very difficult, dangerous problem of how you preserve dynamic stability in flight. And they did it without getting killed. We call this Yankee ingenuity. And it's what we've been all about as a nation since our very inception. They did everything on this plane. They built the internal combustion engine upstairs in the bike shop. They hand-stitched the cotton muslin on these wings. They shaped the wooden spars. They designed the plane. And American history just unfurls thereafter. This is Lindbergh in 27. He takes off with a ton of fuel on board. He's got 5 sandwiches. He's up in the air for 30 hours. He lands in Paris. He's met by 100,000 people. And overnight, Lindbergh becomes the world's first global celebrity. And the reason is quite clear. He had done a godlike thing. He had done a thing human beings could never imagine. He had flown the open ocean. The first goddess is this woman, Amelia, 10 years later. She tries to do something even more daring than Lindbergh to fly all the way around the world. She leaves New Guinea and aims for a tiny island 2,000 miles away in the middle of the Pacific, and she misses it. And we're still looking for her today, but she remains a heroine to many generations of young American girls. This blew me away. This is a picture of my home airport, DIA. As recently as 1975, 80% of us had never flown commercially on a jet aircraft. And this year in the U.S., something like 7 million flights will carry more than 500 million passengers. So in a century, we've gone from a moment when men and women had never flown to a time now where every woman, in effect, is Amelia. And every man is Lindbergh. I think the best visual metaphor for the United States is a space shuttle. These three main space shuttle engines together generate the equivalent of 36,000 megawatts of power. Not the big booster rockets, these are the three space shuttle engines. They're designed to run for 4 minutes at a pop. They have a 4-hour lifetime. We've got 300 million people on board, the most complicated, beautiful, complex, highly engineered civilization the planet has ever seen. And every civilization has strengths and it has weaknesses. And I would argue the weakness of ours is the energy burn, the rate of consumption. And this is what it is on a per person per day basis. It's about 1 million British thermal units per person per day, which is the energy equivalent, 100 pounds of coal or 8 gallons of gasoline, 1,000 cubic feet of natural gas, or one lightning bolt worth of energy per person per day. You can't pick up a magazine without reading about energy now. It's just one of the pivotal issues. This is an ad from Chevron. They're saying it took us 125 years to use the first trillion barrels of oil. We'll use the next trillion in 30. So then in the fine print, they say energy will be one of the defining issues of the coming century. The easy oil is gone. And so all of this then raises a question for me. We've got about 75,000 more people here in the United States than they have on SAMHSA, but we have a aeronautical problem of our own. We have a sustainability challenge of our own. And the challenge is, how do you fly this civilization out to 2050? And what role will renewables play? This morning, 4 million Chinese went underground. To mine coal. 75% of all the energy in China comes from coal. 100 of these men will be dead by week's end. And this is our moment in history. It is kind of a crazy, wonderful, bizarre, insane, delightful, any adjective you want to pull out of the dictionary would work. But this is electricity growth since 1990 in three different countries. And this is another graph. This is an intriguing graph. There are 250 years of human history on this. This is a graph of global carbon emissions from when James Watt invented the steam engine on the left to our present time on the right. Orange is deforestation, so that's cutting down of trees. And the purple, the larger segment here, represents carbon dioxide from the burning of coal, oil, and natural gas. So you can look at this orange-purple thing as exhaust, as smoke, or you can look at it as fire. And if you look at it as fire, it dawns on you that half of all the fossil fuel we've burned in the entire history of our species has been consumed since 1980. People sometimes say, well, what would it take to solve the climate problem? They ask me that. Now, here's another graph looking ahead 300 years. These are three different emissions paths. I early showed you this exponential curve going ahead. So that's coming in from the left in red here. And we've got three or four different emission pathways or emission journeys we could take as a people on the planet, all of us together, all 7 billion of us. If you wanted to keep Vermont in the future within 4 degrees of its current temperature, 4 degrees Fahrenheit, then you would have to follow the second line from the bottom, that darker yellow line. And underneath that line is a green area, and that green area represents a carbon budget. Now, this is a global carbon budget for the next 300 years, and you can see that carbon dioxide emissions would need to peak within a few decades, if not sooner, and then go down for the rest of human history. That's what it would take. That's what it will take to solve the global climate challenge. Now, this is very difficult politically. It's all, Brian would tell you, this is almost impossible because you have to divide this carbon budget amongst nations. And then there's a very interesting ethical issue here because you have to divide it between generations. And in this graph, of course, we've self-allocated the bulk of the carbon budget to the next couple of generations. The flip side of the climate challenge is this burn rate, this rate of consumption, and it's best understood in the context of petroleum. This is a graph of global oil production since 1900 over the last century. When the GIs came home from the war, the end of World War II in 1945, the U.S. was producing two-thirds of all the oil on the planet. The whole planet was using 10 million barrels a day. The U.S. was producing close to 7. And between 1950 and the year 2000, there was an 8-fold expansion in global oil supplies. And this is the half century that you and I grew up in. This is the half century that we now understand as normal. Most experts do not think global oil production is going to increase at all going ahead. They think that global oil production probably stay about where it is, 85 million barrels a day, in that range. Maybe it could grow to 90. Then it's probably likely to stay flat for a few years and then gradually begin going down. So we've come through a half century that's very singular and different and unusual and will not be repeated again on the planet Earth. In that half century, we were drowning in oil, $5 oil, $10 oil. It wasn't just abundant, it was cheap. So this was the time period in which we built the interstate highway system. We drove on the moon. We climbed Mount Everest. We designed a whole agricultural system, a whole land use pattern, a whole transportation pattern around $5 oil, $10 oil, and that cheap oil is gone. It's not that we're running out of oil. There's lots of oil left. But it's not going to be cheap. It's going to be, yesterday it was close to 80. It's going to be $80 oil going up to probably around 120. That's going to be the range in which oil will trade over the next 10 years. Anything above 120, as we found out a year ago, breaks the machine. It devastates truckers. It devastates farmers. It destroys airlines. So arguably, oil's worth a lot more than $120 a barrel, but the global economy can't sustain prices higher than that. Any prices higher than that just throw the whole thing into reverse. That's basically what we've seen happen over the last 12 or 14 months. This is a graph of U.S. oil production. Our domestic production peaked in 1970. We're still a major oil producer in the U.S., but about two-thirds of all the oil, that conventional oil that we produce in this country, has already been burned. I was giving a talk in Oklahoma. I wanted to make sure everyone understood what it means when two-thirds of something is gone.
About four cans and a six-pack.
And this is our petroleum dilemma. And it's a sobering one. If you think of all the oil that we have in this country, original oil endowment, as a six-pack, then four of those cans are gone. We have the remaining two to share amongst ourselves and our children and our grandchildren. So now all of these problems have come together, all these challenges have come together into one single challenge. And I think Brian summarized it nicely. Your lieutenant governor summarized it nicely. We have a security challenge. We have a big jobs challenge.
And this is WGDR Plainfield. We are broadcasting live from the Sheraton in Burlington, the Renewable Energy Vermont keynote speaker, and we will be broadcasting Democracy Now! A bit late, and we return now to the conference.
This year at the federal level, that's equivalent to almost $5,000 per person in the country the feds are borrowing. Climate change, I touched on already, and the way this is going to be framed going ahead in this country is not as a environmental challenge. It's going to be framed as an economic challenge, a challenge of preserving prosperity. And I would argue that energy, again, is going to be at the heart of that discussion. This is a guy you've never heard of. His name is Vaclav Smil. He's the leading energy historian on the planet. And he says to me, I read a lot of his stuff. He's worth reading. He says, energy transitions take decades. If you want to run the world with a larger share of renewable energy, you better get started, he says, because it's going to take some time. It's going to be a lengthy process. We should have started 20 or 30 years ago. Okay, we started a decade ago. That's all the more reason we need to go at full force now. We need to go with power and passion and conviction and public policy support and bipartisan support from both political parties, because the fate of our country is riding on it. Smil says this. He said, we had a fine world and a clever civilization without oil and then with a little oil, and we can do it again. It will not be the end of the world, except perhaps for Californians. I want to talk just briefly about renewable energy and human well-being. There's an economic aspect to this, and there's a deeper heart aspect to this. There's a spiritual side to this. There's an ethical and moral side to it. I have no idea what motivated you to put that wind turbine up, but I think renewable energy forces us to, prompts us to ask a number of intriguing questions. Why are we here? What's our mission on the planet? What do we hope to leave for our kids? What's our obligation to the future? What's our relationship with the biosphere, with the sun and the wind and the water? It raises all kinds of intriguing questions that everybody has to answer for themselves. But I know from personal experience that when you begin wrestling with renewable energy, when you begin buying it, we think of this stuff as technology. Yes, it's technology. Yes, it's economic development. Yes, it's jobs, but it's more than that. We did a solar retrofit on my house. It forced me to ask, how much carbon dioxide is this house producing? Passive solar house, but all electric, was producing about 20,000 pounds a year. So we retrofitted it to cut it down to 5,000. And my kids were involved, and it's changed, you know, my relationship with them and the way we just approach and think about the universe. In my little town in Carbondale, Colorado, western Colorado, we have an annual summer fair. We have a solar system on the town park now. This is our wood chopping contest, and you ought to send somebody out to compete in our wood chopping contest, it occurs to me. I'm sure we have a men's division and women's division, and I would be curious to see your entry in the women's division. We have solar energy on our banks now. We have solar energy on our recreation facilities. We have solar energy on our fire station. We don't build a public building in our town anymore without having a renewable energy system on it. And this makes sense to have it on the bank, because energy, not money, energy is the original currency. And that's a very important notion that the United States is going to begin wrestling with the implications of that as time goes on. It's a design challenge. Energy is a design challenge, renewable energy is a design challenge, and that's intriguing. We have to rethink how we do buildings, we have to rethink transportation, we have to rethink liquid fuels. It's got a technical and engineering and scientific element to it. I was downstairs wandering through the booths yesterday, and I met some guys there that are doing wood gasification. When you go to Europe, 30% of the houses in Austria are heated by wood. It's about 7% in the U.S. So we have to inventory our resources. What wood resources do we have? What water and solar and geothermal resources do we have? I asked one of the exhibitors down there, David, I said, David, send me a picture of some biomass innovators. And he sent me this, and it occurred to me that the difference between a biomass innovator and an axe murderer is probably quite a fine line here in Vermont. But, you know, gasification... gasification is an intriguing technology. Here's your axe murder, just to make sure you can tell the difference. We're going to need close relationships, working relationships with electric utilities. In the past, sometimes renewables and electric utilities have been at odds with each other, but we did $9 billion of large wind in the U.S. in 07. Wind is 2% of U.S. electricity now. I'm convinced it'll be 20 or about the same share as nuclear power within a few decades. I don't think we have a choice. And wind has very high energy return now. It's about 30 to 1. The new thin film solar photovoltaics will be 20 to 1. Conventional oil and gas drilling in the U.S. is now 8 to 1. Corn ethanol is 1.6 to 1. So we're going to be running on electricity as time goes on. Electricity is going to be really important, so we need to have close working relationships with all the utilities in our states. And utilities have done amazing things. This is a graph of energy prices, electricity prices. When Edison first started selling power in 1890, he was selling it for $3.20 a kilowatt hour. In 1992 dollars, and by the end of the century, the national average is around 10. You guys pay more here, you pay about 14, but for 14 cents, you're buying as much work as a grown man can do in a day. A kilowatt hour is enough work to lift a full-size pickup truck 500 feet in the air. If you hired the strongest guy on the high school football team and asked him to dig ditch or string wire for a day, in 8 hours, he'd do a kilowatt hour's worth of work. If you rode a bicycle 100 miles, you'd do a kilowatt hour's worth of work. It's one of the world's great bargains. Electricity is the original, it's the original network. It's the original web. It's both software and hardware. It's the organizing principle for modern civilizations, and we're going to need lots of electricity and lots of clean electricity, carbon-free power going ahead. Utilities will be central to this. Let me just end with a few last slides. I think we're going to be faced with a set of challenges that we have to innovate ourselves through. Innovation, what you guys know as Yankee ingenuity, is going to be at the heart of our journey going ahead. When the Wright brothers first went to Kitty Hawk, so this is 1903, they took these gliders down there. Now, they had built these gliders based on designs, wing shapes that they found in textbooks, but the textbooks were wrong. And they'd carry these gliders up to the top of the sand dunes, face them into the wind, and then fly off the sand dune. And they knew by the end of the summer, this first summer of experimentation, that something was wrong with their wing shape. They were watching hawks soaring above, and they were picking up dead seagulls on the beach and looking very carefully at their wings, and they knew they had the wrong wing shape. Their wing had too much drag and not enough lift on these gliders. So that winter, they went back to Dayton, Ohio, and upstairs in the bike shop, they built this thing on the left here, which is a wind tunnel, simple little wind tunnel, and inside it, they built this measuring device. Now, when you show this to a modern aeronautical engineer, they're dumbfounded. because this thing, its scientific name is a lift balance. It's designed to measure lift and drag. And look what it's built out of. They built this. They designed this. They had never seen one of these. They designed this from scratch using broken bicycle spokes and used hacksaw blades. And that winter, they tested 100 different wing shapes. You can see one there at the top of the picture vertically. And they pounded out all kinds of different wing shapes on their workbench, long, skinny ones, ones with very abrupt curvatures, softer curves. And at the end of the winter, they had this. And this was the wing shape that would enable them to unlock the fourth dimension and give it to all of us. Give it to you and me and our kids. And next time you get on a plane, next time you get on a Boeing or an Airbus, look at the wing. Because within, you know, a few percentage points one way or another, you're flying on a wing that the Wright brothers developed upstairs in the bike shop 100 years ago. They built a new plane, figured out the design of propeller, which is an even more complex sort of visual spatial geometry challenge, and they went back to Kitty Hawk that next summer and they went flying. At the end of his visit to Colorado, Soren said something quite interesting to me. We were in Telluride, everyone was dressed up for Halloween, and there was a theater full of school kids and grown-ups, and he said, you know, on SAMHSA, we no longer wake up fretting about a polar bear. He said, don't think global and act local. Just act local. If enough of us do, then someday all of us together may do something good for a polar bear. So good luck in your work. I appreciate being here.